Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org, and thanks.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Here an examination of the road ahead for the McLean County Nursing Home. County Board Chair John McIntyre says using part of the facility as a temporary rehab center is a strong possibility.
It's a great effect on the bottom line. First of all, private pay and qualifications for Medicare are much more lucrative when it comes to revenue.
McIntyre also tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker the county home will continue to be a place for people who can't afford other care. GLT's Laura Kennedy previews the Art Tech Film Fest at the Normal Theater. The festival begins tomorrow. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner stops by to talk about downtown, liquor laws, and spending on street repair. Ryan Denham has the live interview. All of that plus a GLT news update on the way. It's April 24th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council has made some big spending decisions on streets and sidewalk repairs, plus a controversial change to where alcohol can be sold in Bloomington. You'll hear about all of that and more in Ryan Denham's conversation with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal stopped by GLT's Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Ryan. It's great to be here.
Last night, the council approved a bunch of spending on streets and sidewalks, including $4 million for this year's resurfacing projects. A couple notable streets on the hit list this year, Jefferson Street cutting right through downtown, Front Street downtown, Fairway and Regency, IAA Drive, just to name a few. Mayor, do you think the city is spending enough on streets at this point?
No. Because I think that when we need $70 to $80 million to get to in good shape, and so we've got a long way to go. And now let's also be clear: the total amounts that you see on street resurfacing, you actually and sidewalk repairs, and potholes and whatever would bring us somewhere around $10 million a year, which is a substantial sum, given that there were times where we spent nothing on street resurfacing. And that's part of the problem, is years of neglect have produced this. So at this point, I think that there's more that we can do. It's one of the reasons why I am in favor of a 4 penny a gallon gas tax that has to be used, no matter what, by Illinois law for street resurfacing related infrastructure problems. And so the answer to the question, getting back to it, is no. I think we can spend more. I think we can do more. This is good. What IDOT is doing, because IDOT owns a lot of our roads and it's their responsibility, is a good thing. They're finally stepping up to the plate a little bit. But we have so many problems with our streets.
Well, let's circle back to the local motor fuel tax issue you just raised. So this is something that Alderman talked about back in February, I think it was. And city staff had proposed raising the local motor fuel tax by 4 cents, which is basically doubling it to bring in more than $2 million in additional money for streets. Alderman seemed kind of cool to the idea at that point. Could that still happen, though, even by that same amount or less? Do you expect that to come back before the council here in the short term?
Yes. I mean, at some point, we're going to be considering our capital improvement projects in more detail, capital improvement plan, excuse me. And those capital improvement plans have to be funded. So if it's not a 4 cent a gallon gas tax, then what is it? Now, one of the advantages, I would say, of a 4 cent a gallon gas tax, I mean, I don't want to pay it any more than anybody else, is that 30% of it is paid by people who do not live in Bloomington, but they drive on our streets. And so I think that's one of the things. The other is, it is based, except for those who own electric cars, on a kind of a usage sort of basis. So the more that you drive, the more that you'd pay. But at the end of the day, it has to be earmarked by state law. So no future councils can touch that money and put it into anything else. So for a variety of reasons, I do strongly favor that. And I whether or not it's this summer or maybe it's next summer, maybe we have enough this summer. Maybe council decides not to act on it till later. And then, of course, we a year from now, we'll have a new council. You know, maybe not everybody, of course, but there are five seats that are up. And so we'll see what happens at that point.
Well, speaking of big, expensive things, let's talk O'Neill Park pool. Well, last night, you got an update on work that's underway on the new parks master plan, essentially a roadmap for city parks for the next 15 years. Big part of that, though, is the aging O'Neill Park pool on Bloomington's west side. Badly needs renovation. What's your sense of where the council may go when it comes to that pool's future?
Well, my sense is the council will probably fix O'Neill Pool to make it a little better than it was. I favor it being an aquatic center. I think this is one of those times where you do make this a destination for the West Side. Alderman Black last night said, you know, when you look at the parks on the West Side and the East Side, there's no comparison. The McGraw Park, which is a wonderful park, is a Taj Mahal. Compared to the little huts that we have, the equivalent of that on the west side. So I think it's about time that we stepped up to the plate. The other thing is depending upon usage, it might come close to paying for itself. It's near interstates. If we get some additional traffic, if it's really not just a pool, it's actually an aquatic center, it might very well pay for itself. The other thing, though, that was a little puzzling to me last night, the first time I've heard about it, was the concept of having a central park, Ewing Park 1, 2, and 3. And so I'm kind of interested in what that means. My concept of parks and recreation in Bloomington has always meant that we, as much as possible, try to have neighborhood parks, things that are as accessible as possible. Maybe we just have one dog park that is centrally located, but I'm not quite sure what it means. This is not Midtown Manhattan. We don't have a central park. And so it'll be interesting to see what how that unfolds as well.
And my understanding is that actually came then from your consultant on this Greenplay. He mentioned, this is sort of a trend in recreation to move toward municipal-centered parks. Is that basically what you heard last night?
Yes. And again, I'm not sure. We need to flesh that out to figure out exactly what that means. But mostly kids in Bloomington are used to walking to their local park. And I think that that's an important amenity that we have within our city. And we should that's, I think, what we should continue to pursue, unless there's something, as I say, like a dog park would be something quite specialized. I think the Ewing parks are quite suited for vast areas where people go sledding, and then maybe we have an area where dogs can go off the leash, and so we will see.
So going back to O'Neill Park pool, you mentioned that if you do it the right way, it could become a destination even for people from out of town to come in and
Absolutely.
Then potentially pay for itself. So what does an aquatic center approach to renovating O'Neill Pool? What does that cost, something like that? What kind of cost are we talking about?
Well, somewhere around $10, $12 million. And again, it has been proposed that we float that over about 20 years. And if you do that, the interest rates are currently quite low. And that's what I mean by being able to potentially pay for itself. You're not going to get that $12 million in a year, but it's like buying your house. Your house is maybe amortized over 30 years, and you probably still have something valuable after 30 years, we hope, right? And so that's the same concept with respect to capital expenditures. If you don't invest in your community, if you don't invest in amenities, quality of life things, then it's going to be harder for you to make the case that you're a vibrant community for economic development. So I would love to have that as one of my bragging rights, if you will, as I'm searching and talking to people about what to do about downtown or about State Farm or about Eastland Mall. So we have lots of good things to talk about. I'd like to have even more. I mean, obviously, we've got Constitution Trail. We do have a great park system, but I'd like it to be even greater.
And what you're describing here, though, would that mean that you wouldn't need some alternative revenue source to pay the debt on these renovations? So you wouldn't need to do something like the utility tax increase or the video gaming licensing fee that you guys have
You'd have to do some sort of fund up front. It may turn out that it pays for itself. You can't count on that coming up for that. So I believe the figure was something like $19 a household if we raise property taxes, or if we raised utility taxes, that would more than pay off any note on O'Neill Park. And then it is putting it into an aquatic center. We're going to have to spend something anyway. We're going to have, even if we spend $5 million, I'd rather spend the $7 million extra, make it a destination, give the West Side something that it can be proud of, let the West Side understand that they are part of our community too, that we're giving them a jewel, not just the wealthy part of town, and given its location to interstates, to possibly be a destination for people from other communities or even Normal or other parts of Bloomington to come to this special aquatic center.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner recapping last night's city council meeting. Let's pivot and talk booze, specifically where you can buy it.
From recreation to booze.
I know.
Okay.
This is quite a fun-filled show. City council last night approved tinkering with liquor laws. This change essentially prevents convenience stores that sell alcohol from opening within 100 feet of schools, churches, also added daycares to this list of no-go zones. What do you think of the changes that were made last night?
Right. Well, again, just the churches and other things and schools were already in the code. What was added was daycare, and it was really aimed at a particular project, the Circle K project, that frankly we still have yet to receive an application for a liquor license for this facility. So it's a possible facility at the corner of GE Road and Hershey. The thing that I have difficulty with is changing our code for all places throughout the city because we don't want a particular project. We already have a liquor code that would allow us to stop a liquor license in an area where we feel that it could be harmful to the immediate neighborhood or to the local community. That is part of state law, and it's part of our ordinance. So that's the question, but that's a concern that I have over that. And so at this point, whether or not Circle K proceeds, I don't know. But that is land that's going to be used for something. We have the greatest control if somebody wants a liquor license. If somebody wanted to go in there and put in something else, we may have absolutely no control over it because it's zoned for business. So I think the nicest thing, of course, I'm sure for residents would be for it to remain a vacant lot. It's not going to remain a vacant lot. And so I think those are some of the hard realities that we did have as part of our discussion last night, but the council did vote by 5-4 to change the zoning laws.
Well, what is I know you may not be a supporter of this necessarily, but what is sort of the logic of it? Have there been problems with alcohol and proximity to daycares that maybe sparked
not
interest
that
in
I've
this?
Ever heard of? As I joked last night, and it was a joke, but it was meant to get at the broader theme, and that is, I've never heard of a 5-year-old coming out of a convenience store with a 12-pack of Bud. And the issue, I mean, it sounds bad, alcohol near daycare, right? But what would be more problematic would be having traffic patterns. We don't want the traffic patterns, let's say, from any business to be too close to a daycare center. The other would be we don't want people drinking, you know, and maybe having an environment that's problematic for a daycare. And that we can take care of under our existing license, powers. And that is specifically, we can say you can't serve single serves. You can't sell single serves. You have to sell 12 packs. Well, that doesn't mean that nobody ever is going to open up one of their 12 packs and start drinking it. But it's a very different culture if you have single serves. And so we have done that under many situations where we've had convenience stores that were near, for example, neighborhoods. And that tends to encourage people to hang around, and it encourages other behavior that the police have documented as well. The police also did note at the Liquor Commission meeting that there have never been any problems that they can find at any of the other Circle Ks. So I think Circle K has a good, very good reputation. And I don't know if something could have been done with how they would design their parking lot so that the traffic would only come in a different direction, maybe a couple hundred feet away from the daycare. I don't know if that was possible. But at this point, the property line to property line probably means that the Circle K is dead. And it was, as I say, by a 5-4 vote. You could have stopped Circle K without changing the ordinance, though. And that is my main issue.
Yeah, so go into that just one level deeper if you can. So are you talking about the city's liquor commission? You can actually, if somebody raises a neighborhood concern about a potential licensee, you can sort of stop it, or at least confront it.
Yes, the neighborhood conditions and its impact on the neighborhood is one of the things that's part of Illinois law. It's also part of our ordinance. So the mayor is, in a sense, the liquor commissioner and can not hire, nobody gets any money, but can appoint one or more people to help them. I have appointed two people to help me with that situation. So we currently have a liquor commissioner, myself and two others. And we could say, wow, all right, we've got daycare here. We've got neighbors who are opposed to it. It's a neighborhood operation. And we've done it before. We said, no. No liquor license, and we're not even going to bring it to the council. Or even if the liquor commission did, we could bring it to the council with no recommendation to say, hey, we've had some proponents, we've had some opponents. We're bringing this to you with no recommendation, and the council then can, at that point, kill it.
Is there a concern about potential unintended consequences on other future projects, even beyond the scope of Circle K? If you have a business that wants to come into property that just so happens to be near a daycare or one of these other types of facilities, do you think it could slow down other projects down the road?
It absolutely could. That's a great question. Ryan, you obviously do your homework and you're understanding some of the implications of economic development. And that's absolutely the case. So it may be that a restaurant or a grocery store that might want to locate, let's say, across from Meyer, which is not far from a church, or somebody else might want to, on the west side, open up a grocery store where they want to sell packaged liquor that might be next to or near within that 100 feet of some sort of daycare. So absolutely, there could be issues that are associated with that. That's what I mean when I say I'm uncomfortable with the one size fits all, a change in our ordinance to apply to the entire city of Bloomington, when the real goal, I think everybody knows, is to stop Circle K from locating at that particular location. Alderwoman Painter last night suggested that they go down the street, and they might decide to do that. I have no idea. But it was at that particular location that residents and Alderwoman Painter, and then ultimately, of course, it turns out a majority of the council said that they were willing to change the entire ordinance in order to prevent that business from going at that location.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. Mayor Renner, let's talk downtown Bloomington. Last week, aldermen met to discuss the Downtown Task Force report. We're going to talk about what actions, if any, the council will ultimately take to put those recommendations into action. What were your takeaways from that meeting last week and what it could mean short-term for downtown?
Sure. And I think most of the discussion here was short-term, not any kind of anchor projects. But I think in terms of additional signage and additional parking for downtown, we're also, last night we did vote to refinance the Frontier lots, finance the Frontier lots as opposed to just pay for it out of our reserves. So there are many movable parts in downtown, and I think we are making progress on some areas, in spite of the fact that State Farm is obviously abandoning its building and is going to be putting it up for sale, in spite of the fact we still have the front and center building. So we still have some challenges downtown, to say the least, but I was optimistic that there was lots of what you might call low or fairly low-lying fruit that we can continue to move forward on to make our cultural historic core downtown an even more exciting place to live, work, and play.
Well, what are you hearing on the State Farm building? Has there been any interest that's trickled down to the city at this point?
Oh, absolutely. I had people calling me the day after. The difficulty is, of course, it's a little different than some other things. It is they need to buy the property from State Farm first. Okay, we do not own it. So we need to see something tangible, and then we could even do hypotheticals. But you got to have some sort of clear business plan, pro forma. Tell us what you're thinking. What is your financial gap? And let's be clear: we don't give any money that we currently have. So any project would have to pay for itself. So let's say if it was retail, and we might say, all right, you buy this building, you retrofit it, you take the risks, you spend whatever, $12 million, $10 million on the building, and you spend $3 million renovating it, and we will give you our share of the sales taxes for 8 years or 10 years or 7 years or whatever it might be as part of the incentive package. So that's money that we're not getting now. We are not getting any sales taxes on the State Farm building, right? There are other areas like a TIF district, former Electrolux site. We are getting no property taxes on that site now. Nobody is, right? It's all tax-exempt property. So anything that would go on that site would generate new revenue.
And as you mentioned, State Farm is a different case because it does have an active owner who is marketing the property.
It does have an active owner, right.
There are other properties downtown, though, that have been vacant for a much longer time. And the front and center building you've already mentioned is an example for years. It's just been sort of sitting there. Does the city have any real options when it comes to eminent domain with
Absolutely.
Commercial vacancies like that?
Absolutely.
What are those options?
It takes a long time, and it's costly legally, but that is one of the things that we're going to be talking about this summer is how quickly and decisively do we move in terms of eminent domain on from the front and center building. And the Huffs may let it sit there and rot, and technically it does not violate any of our codes externally right now in terms of broken windows or whatever, but that doesn't mean that we can't go forward. If there ever was a case for eminent domain, the front and center building ought to be a poster child for moving forward with that.
Just south of downtown is the YMCA, and I'll let you out here on this. Earlier this month, the YMCA Bloomington Normal announced plans to move eastward to a new building that they'd share on OSF's campus with Easter Seals, that near Veterans Parkway there. What'd you think of that announcement and that move eastward?
I've known about this for a couple of years, so I've known that it's been in the works. And I knew certainly well over a year ago that it was a virtual certainty. I think it could potentially help Eastland Mall and the revitalization of Eastland Mall. I wish they would also stay at their current location. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's not possible. One of the things that was discussed is possible privatization of some parts of our recreation in our recreation plan. And I'd like to, and I have talked many times with the Y about keeping their current facility open, but having us contract with them to make it financially feasible for them to keep their current location open, since we do not have the equivalent of a rec center in Bloomington or in Normal.
I've heard that building's in pretty bad shape, though. Do you think it has a future?
The building itself actually is it's not attractive, but it is a solid building, right? So it may not be the prettiest, but it does have a pool, and it does have an ability to play basketball. It does have it's a recreation complex. So without major investments, it would be interesting to see whether or not we could work out a relationship with the Y so that we could have another center of neighborhood recreation within our city.
That's Terry Renner, the mayor of Bloomington. Thanks for coming in today, Terry.
Thank you, Ryan. Take care.
I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington Normal stopped by GLT's Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings next week. You'll hear from City Manager Pam Reese. It's Sound Ideas.
Support Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
We asked GLT contributors why they financially support NPR and GLT News.
I just trust GLT and NPR so that by the time I get to work, I feel I'm fully informed on what's happening.
One of the things I like about NPR is it tends to give a pretty balanced set of perspectives on kind of two sides of the coin on a lot of those stories.
Join these listeners, make a first-time contribution, or renew your commitment now at WGLT.org.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 103.5 and 89.1 FM, GLT and WGLT.org. This fund drive, we're continuing our commitment to fundraising that respects your time. That's why we're only asking for your help in regular station breaks like this one. The fund drive goal is to raise $100,000 in listener support by April 30th. With your help, we can do it. Renew your support or make your first-time contribution right now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas coming up. It's a preview of the Art Tex Film Festival in Normal. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The short-term course is set for the McLean County Nursing Home. The county board has approved a blueprint for changing business lines and making improvements based on a study by a blue ribbon panel of healthcare professionals. County Board Chair John McIntyre tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker. First up on the list is joining an Accountable Care Association, or ACO, which involves partnering with a hospital.
It's an organization that actually helps the hospitals work with their patients to place people who need to be, once they're released from the hospital, but still need some kind of either rehabilitation or placement into a nursing home. And it's an organization that the county was involved with at one time. It hasn't been. It requires at least a 2-star recommendation for a rating, and so that was one immediate suggestion that we need to do.
How does that make placement easier if you have this working relationship with a hospital about care? What about the relationship is ongoing?
Well, I think, number one, it shows that the nursing homes care. They work with the families sometimes while the patient is in the hospital in helping them. Make the decision when they get out where they want to go. I think that's very important for many families, especially those who may be not sure what they're going to do financially as well. Sometimes that's a strange adventure for people. It's threatening. It's unnerving to have to put a loved one in a nursing home type of situation. It's just provide guidance, counseling, some kind of answer questions, provide information for family members as well.
And then the hospitals also get to send their workers to the nursing homes for rehab checks or for ongoing checks, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think that's very important.
Unpack that. Well, how does that help the continuum of care?
Well, it helps, first of all, the hospitals want to be confident that they're doing a good job with releasing people and giving them proper direction. It helps the communication between hospital staff, doctors, and nursing home staff as well to see that there's a follow-through, provision of proper care. If you're not involved with that and you don't really have an opportunity to know the people, and then it's more difficult for the families.
How does the ongoing dialogue between a hospital and a nursing home help keep standards of care high?
Expectations. Directors of nursing, people working in the business, following guidelines. There's a total criteria of response time, how you deal with medications. It's a confidence thing that works both ways. The panel also suggested, and I think it's good because this is a public nursing home that they can provide training for the hospitals, training for the schools of nursing and university on a site where, you could equate it to a lab type of situation, lab school at times as well.
Nursing students always need clinical experience.
Clinical training, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Has the nursing home not been one of those sites?
They have been, but it's been somewhat limited, and we feel like there's definitely an opportunity there. Also, Our nursing home has the facilities that could very easily provide rehabilitation services on short-term care. And that was another suggestion that the panel said, you know, there's no reason why with a separate entrance, as like rehab patients sometimes would want, separate entrance and dining. Some of the semi-private rooms that were deemed originally to be not a good situation could very easily become private rooms and very easily be used on short-term rehabilitation services.
So if some of the nursing home's capacity could be used for rehab or for placement on a temporary basis from hospitals to get them out of a hospital setting, how much does that affect the bottom line potentially?
It's a great effect on bottom line. First of all, private pay and Medicare. Qualifications for Medicare are much more lucrative when it comes to revenue. Our nursing home should be, and I know that's a philosophical question, should be a place, though, for people who can't afford care, and that's Medicaid. But Medicaid does not pay, and any time that any of these nursing homes, private nursing homes, who are dual certified with Medicare or Medicaid, can have an opportunity to have someone come there. The choice has been primarily for to take Medicare patients because it pays so much better. The county does get an intergovernmental transfer that the state set up to help make up some difference with Medicaid, which the other private homes do not have. And so there are some opportunities to take advantage of that as well.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre about the McLean County Nursing Home. To be used as a rehab site or a temporary site for people that are likely soon to be discharged, to qualify as that, the nursing home would have to be eligible for waivers, because usually Medicare requires 3 days of a hospital stay before you can be placed out in a nursing home somewhere. And the hospitals are saying often that's not necessary. You know, if you undergo a surgical procedure and you're no longer in acute care, you don't need to be in a hospital. You can be in a rehab facility, or you can be in a lower standard of care than the acute care beds that are in the hospital, than the skilled the skilled care beds. What does McLean County Nursing Home need to do to qualify for that kind of patient?
Well, actually, not very much. It is a skilled nursing facility. It would be very easy to have staff there available to work along with the rehab patients. Parking is conducive. The way that building is structured, outside entrance, separate entrance would be conducive. Sometimes, talk about if you're a rehab patient, you know you're short-term, maybe you don't want to be in the regular nursing home, but the way the wings are set up and the design of that home, the naysayers were saying, oh, this place is just not, you know, conducive. You couldn't renovate it. You can do some things. In some cases, as the panel pointed out, it was kind of positive, you didn't have to renovate much. It's not a large amount of money. It's just a matter of readjusting your organization and what you're trying to provide in services and goals.
The lone naysayer to embarking on the Blue Ribbon Panel's recommendations was George Wendt, who does not think the county should be in the nursing home business at all. What do you say to him?
Well, I said a lot. George and I have had a lot of conversations about this. It's a philosophical difference. It's a difference in how he sees the need for the citizens. I think he's looking at it purely as dollar and cents. George has always been a very valuable member of our board because he does take an approach, I'd say ultra-conservative approach, to protect the taxpayers. I would like for him to have to reason with me a little bit more, but he was pretty much predetermined that there were no possibilities. And he's basing that on the history of nursing homes around the state that are county nursing homes. We have these pretty good debates going on between him and I about that sometimes.
Why did the rest of the board think that McLean County's experience will be different in profitability than Champaign or Peoria County?
When I offered to try to find people that were experts in the business and had experience and not just an outside consultant, but some people that understood our community as well, had been here for years and years, I wasn't sure what they would come up with any kind of recommendations. If they would have gotten together, and you know many of those people, you're well-respected in the community, and made a recommendation we should close the nursing home. You know, there was some, I would say, some backing for that. But in this case, as soon as they rolled their sleeves up and dug right in, they came up with a lot of great suggestions and said, no, this is very good. All of them have been out there, have worked with the nursing home. Some of our panel members were even regional directors. Two of our members on the board are long-term care placement people who are actually still working with the hospitals, and they do this daily. They've taken a look at our situation out there and our home, and they say, we have a 4-star rating. That's the second best in town. And it's just a matter of making some adjustments.
And there's 1 5-star, 1 4-star, and everyone else is no more than a 2-star.
Yes.
So that's a strength, and the facility is not as much of a down check, even though it's from the 70s, as was originally thought. Mm-hmm. But that won't always be the case. If the short-term recommendations do produce a break-even point or close to a break-even mm-hmm. point, the county board is likely to say, okay, taking care of the elderly people who are needy mm-hmm. is worth paying something.
Yes.
But over the longer term, what will be necessary to maintain the service at a zero-cost level, considering that the facility is never going to get any younger?
The facility is absolutely correct. It's not going to get any younger. But some of the renovations that we ultimately thought were going to be prohibitive. And as Mr. Wentz says, $25 million, we're going to have to build a new nursing home. That's not the case. There are possibilities with that home. The upkeep can be better. We can hire someone to come in and take a look at it, assess the facility, and do some renovation as needed, but with a purpose. Some of the adjacent counties who've built new nursing homes and have struggled some now have an operating debt. They have a capital expenditure with a debt service. We do not. In fact, our county has done better. So when people say, well, every county, I say, well, we're not every county. And we do have good people here, and we have had good fiscal management, and we feel it's very possible. Now, let me take this a step further. We have 28 departments in our county, a lot of departments that we run. Obviously, almost all of them operate at a deficit. That's why we have tax money. That's why we're a governmental body. Maybe a couple of them are generating enough revenue on their own, but primarily we have to rely on grants, fees, tax money dedicated. But that's our purpose. That's our mission. That's what we do. Probably two or three of our departments or two or three of our adventures that we do, and nursing home being one of them, of course we don't have to have. But on the other hand, I think it was pretty much agreed by the panel and our board that nursing home has provided a valuable service to our citizens as much as some of our other things. It's not mandated. It's not statutorily required to have one. But we can't do everything just based on that as long as we find ways we can manage it and break even. Or come close to breaking even and dedicate a little bit of the funds for that. Is it worth it? Yeah, I think it is.
Do you think that capital improvements to the existing facility will allow the county to maintain that service through the demographic bulge that the baby boomer retirements and aging out presents to the nation? Is McLean County's nursing home going to last another 30 or 40 years until that cohort ages out and passes?
That's exactly why I think the nursing home needs to be there. Now, maybe private enterprise is going to go out and try to build more facilities, but the need is still going to be there. And there is always going to be that mission statement, that need for a Medicaid-type patients. And as like you said, as the bulge or the growth of baby boomers' needs go, as we, like myself, all get to that stage, then there's going to have to be facilities that are available. The nursing homes that are struggling, they're either smaller facilities, the ratings haven't been as good, they have a majority of Medicaid patients as well. And if any of those close, then the need just continues to be more and more for us to have a place for people.
McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre says the county will have to do a long-term assessment of the facility needs, as well as constantly monitor changing business conditions in long-term care. He says the Blue Ribbon Panel will remain in place to help with that effort. McIntyre spoke with Charlie Schlenker for GLT Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield. One system, 83,000 students, 22,000 degrees awarded each year. That's the U of I system, altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Get ready to geek out over a film festival that will appeal to everyone who has dropped a quarter or maybe multiple quarters on Pac-Man, Super Mario, or Tetris. Laura Kennedy has more.
In the 2012 film Wreck-It Ralph, the title character sets off on a journey through a variety of arcade video games.
I don't want to be the bad guy anymore. Ralph abandoned his game.
Where's the wrecking guy?
Welcome to Game Central Station. Trains for all game destinations now boarding.
Everything changes.
That's pretty much what the third annual Arts Tech Film Fest aims to do this week at the Normal Theater. The Film Fest, running Wednesday through Sunday, features movies inspired by video games. Organizer Rick Valentin is an associate professor of arts technology at Illinois State University, and he says he chose this theme because increasingly, more than films, video games are a key cultural touchstone for young people.
Right. So even if they're making film references, I think they're making film references in context of video games. Right. So someone won't say, oh, that reminds me of Scarface. You know, it reminds me of
Grand Theft Auto.
Right. And you start realizing, oh, even though they're film references in all these video games, they don't necessarily see the films. It's that the people who have been influenced by the films make the games and then the video games become the reference. And so I think it was just that idea that, wow, let's try to connect something so that this younger audience who loves video games, they actually get a little bit of the film context too, and maybe some of the references that they see in their media now.
I'm surprised that they don't want to see the film that's connected to the video game. Aren't they kind of missing out?
Well, that's the thing. I think they do, but that was part of the problem when we were putting together the festival, is that there are not a lot of good video game movies, right? So there are plenty of video game movies, right? There's a Mortal Kombat movie, which is
not good.
Laughingly terrible, yeah. And you can name almost every movie that's been made. Yeah. All those movies, yeah, and there's a new Tomb Raider coming out. There are a huge number of movies made from video games, and I think a lot of people who love video games, maybe when they're younger, right, they get excited, oh, there's a Warcraft movie, and then they'll go see it, and then they'll realize pretty quickly after they've seen a couple movies made out of their favorite video games that, wow, it's not usually very good. A movie's not that great.
Why is that? Why is it hard to translate across these two different platforms?
I think it's because, obviously, I think the obvious thing is video games are interactive, and it's a different type of engagement, right? So films are somewhat passive. I know you can make the argument that you're participating, right? But radio is more interactive, right, for instance, than film, as film gives you the visual and the audio. Video games, they give you the visual and the audio, but they give you some more choice in narrative and everything like that. And somebody can spend 80 hours playing a video game, whereas an 80-hour film is very, very difficult to capture someone unless it's interactive in some way. So I think the problem is that you're trying to take something that's interactive and convert it into this more passive form, and then all of a sudden narrative becomes much more important, because in video games, it can be the environment, the characters, right? Those can drive you, and there's some narrative that drives you, but there's the game element, achievement, right? It's more like real life, right? And in a way, whereas trying to translate something to film, a lot of times it's just, oh, it's the name, a couple of characters, and an environment, but a truly great film requires narrative, I think. And that's not true either. I mean, from an avant-garde perspective, right, a film doesn't have to have narrative, but I think for mainstream appeal, right, or even medium stream appeal, right, there has to be a narrative.
We just saw the release of Spielberg's latest film, Ready Player One. Do you think this this film, which you know, incorporates video games and virtual reality into its narrative, do you think this might be a film that actually sort of breaks through and actually is successful?
I think it is successful, right? People went to see it, but I think in a way it is still one of those video game movies, kind of trying to translate that game environment into a film itself. I think in some ways, narratively speaking, Ready Player One's basically a game, like looking for three keys and then at the end you win, right? And then there's a lot of interesting stuff around it, but it doesn't necessarily engage on a narrative level. Right. And so I'm more interested in filmmakers who are trying to bridge that gap. Right. So I think Scott Pilgrim versus the World is one of the films we're showing. And so that film, even though it's not necessarily a game movie, it uses some game narrative. Scott has to go through his all the exes of his potential new girlfriend. And so that's game like. And then their visuals and kind of the narrative itself has game like elements. But there's still a story, characters, relationships. There's depth there. That's more about getting a hybrid of video games and film, whereas I think Ready Player One is great, but it's very superficial. It's not a great Steven Spielberg movie, and it's not a great video game movie. It's kind of this very flashy thing, but as you dig deeper, I don't feel like it's the Citizen Kane of video game movies, right? And so somebody else is going to make that, or the Citizen Kane of video games film hybrid, right, where you have a narrative and but people play it interactive. That's interactive film is always the future. I've been hearing about interactive film for 20 or 30 years, but no one's made that yet. And so I think what's interesting about Ready Player One is it's obvious we need to have this fusion, and everyone's experimenting now. At some point, we're going to get a really interesting hybrid. We're just not there yet, but we're getting closer, I think.
Rick, how has video game culture actually changed over the years? I mean, some of our first films that you have in this film fest, like The Last Starfighter, that came out in 1984. Now we also have Wreck-It Ralph is part of this lineup, which came out in 2012. A lot of changes happened over those years. How has that culture changed?
Well, I think the big change is it started out in an odd way as being a communal culture, because you had to go to an arcade. And so that's my earliest memory of video games, is that you had to go somewhere and you saw other people your age there, and it was a place that was kind of like a precursor to a bar or something. When you were underage, there were very few places to go to in the 80s and late 70s, and so the arcade was a communal experience. And then all of a sudden the home systems made it somewhat more isolated. I think now we're moving in, now that people have massive multiplayer online games, that communal thing is happening again, but it's very different, right? Everyone's in their houses.
And in their different countries.
Yeah, all across the world, right? But they're getting together in this community. And so it's this interesting cycle, this kind of change from communal experience to isolation and then back to communal.
The first film that you're going to be showing, as I mentioned, The Last Starfighter from 1984. I remember this film. I actually saw it in a drive-in movie theater. It goes back to 1984. Why did you choose this one?
It was a big question about Tron. So people always ask, why aren't you showing Tron? And it's like, well, I feel like everyone's seen Tron now. Tron has been...
It had a sequel and everything.
It had a sequel. My kids know Tron. People play this Tron video game from a few years ago still. And so Tron has moved from being this cult overlooked classic to being mainstream.
More mainstream,
And so Last Starfighter feels the same way that Tron did, in that it a lot of people missed out on it the first time around. I didn't see it the first time around in the theaters, and I was the audience for this movie. And so The Last Starfighter is from the very beginning of CGI, computer graphics. So Tron has those computer graphics, but you're within a game. And The Last Starfighter has a huge number of spaceships, boulders, asteroids built, the whole environment's built in a computer using computer graphics, and that it's one of the first films to do that.
On the night of the 26th, you're going to be showing a film from 1999 called Existence, and this is interesting. Did I say that right?
It's actually in the film they pronounce it Existence, and so it's something about video game culture. It's that idea that like the capitalization is weird, and
yes.
They pronounce things weird. The company that makes the game Existence is called Pilgrimage, even though it looks like pilgrimage, right? So it's all about this kind of clicky, kind of underground pronunciation thing in the film.
Well, it's interesting because you have one of my favorite actresses of all time, Jennifer Jason Leigh, is in this film, and she's a woman game designer. And yeah. So we're getting the female perspective of basically a world that was really, particularly in 99, heavily male dominated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's the great thing about it is the lead character is a game designer, but it's a woman. And so often games and gaming culture are associated with men, and that's not the reality of it. Again, I have lots of students, and I'd say it's 50-50, the ones that identify as just like hardcore gamers, right? It's male and female. And so that's not the actual world. And so having a character that is the designer, that's great. And then what's interesting about it is, not to get too deep into the psychology of David Cronenberg, but it's also the controllers and the devices are more feminine in a way, right? So that's one of the complaints about, you know, like joysticks and everything like that. The controllers are very masculine, you know, in video game culture. And David Cronenberg goes, so you plug in with the game pods with something that's very much like an umbilical cord and everything like that. And so there's not just a female lead, but it's kind of this female perspective of what would the game world look like if it had, if it wasn't just male dominated. So that's an interesting part of the film.
On the 28th, you have a film from 2012, Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah.
And that's animation.
Yeah.
Why did you choose Wreck-It Ralph to be part of the Arts Tech Film Fest?
Well, what's great about Wreck-It Ralph is it in a way, is a history of arcade games and video games, because Wreck-It Ralph, the character, is from a 1980s, early 80s arcade game, and then he travels through these other games, and they're all arcade games, but how I always remember when the big kind of alien attack games and started showing up in the arcade, and it was like, wow, this is really weird with the big guns and everything like that. So he travels through games like that, and then travels through a game that's candy oriented and everything like that. And so in a way, it gives you an idea of the history of arcade games, especially because he kind of travels through that history along with the narrative itself.
Rick Valentin says now that virtual reality technology has developed, the next stage is creating meaningful content. He says the distance between virtual reality and current video gaming is the distance between primitive video game Pong and graphically complex video games with storylines. Valentin is the director of the Arts Tech Film Fest, running Wednesday through Sunday at the Normal Theater in Uptown. He spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. The festival's closing night on Sunday features a live concert of music and digital projections created by Arts Tech students, as well as a virtual reality setup. It's Sound Ideas. You're listening to the theme to Tetris. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with the help today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of the show. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.